Living in the era of COVID-19 raises more questions than we have answers for. Is it safe to get a haircut? What about going to a restaurant? Do I need to wipe down the mail? And can I take my kids to see their grandparents? Given all we still don't know about the virus and the constant flow of information and sometimes misinformation, it can be hard to separate the speculative from the certain and the pseudoscience from the actual science, let alone actually come to an informed decision about some of these questions. Our next guest is here to talk about how you can come up with a framework for evaluating risk and making the best decision for you and your loved ones, as well as when to change your mind. Joining us now is economist Emily Oster. She teaches at Brown University, is the author of multiple books, including the bestseller Crib Sheet, a data-driven guide to better, more relaxed parenting from birth to preschool. She's the creator of the new online resource COVIDExplained.org, which synthesizes, contextualizes, and organizes many of these COVID-related issues you may be searching for answers on. Emily, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, we want to invite you to join in our conversation. We want to know what safety decisions have been the most challenging for you during the pandemic. You can share your thoughts on Twitter with us by tweeting at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. So I'm curious about how your training as an economist helps you sort of, you know, organize and synthesize and distill all this information on some of these COVID-related safety questions.
Yeah, so I think that where the training as an economist really comes in is in the decision-making piece. So in some ways, economics is really the science of decision-making and how we think about trading off costs and benefits. And so a lot of what I've been doing in the work about COVID is just helping people sort of frame those choices and say, okay, how can I set up these decisions in a way that helps me trade off the risks and benefits? I think the other piece that has been helpful is that economics is kind of also about bringing data in to think about some of those questions. And so we have sort of the two pieces. On the one hand, the decision-making piece and the costs and benefits. And on the other hand, the data piece and trying to process what do we really know from the data and how can we incorporate that into this broader decision process.
You know, so in your newsletter, which people can find on Substack, one of the recent pieces you wrote is you get a lot of questions from people looking for answers on specific scenarios, right? And we've had this experience on the show. We've had public health officials on. We asked, you know, are you getting a haircut? Are you going to a restaurant? But one of the points that drew me to your piece that I thought was so interesting is that everyone's situation is so different. And instead of an answer, what people really need is a framework for making their decisions. Can you talk about why that is?
Yeah, so I have a lot of the same questions. People will write me these very specific things like, my in-laws live in this state and we live in this state, and which rest stop should they stop at if they're driving, you know? And I kind of realized at some point, well, I could try to address each of those questions, but actually the questions are so different and they're so specific to the people that what people need is not an answer. I mean, they ultimately need an answer, but no one can answer all those questions. They really need like a way to decide. And so I, in some of these pieces, have sort of started by saying, okay, here's an overarching framework. Here's a sort of simple process where you can start by thinking what's really the question you're asking, and then kind of work through the risks and how to mitigate the risks and how to evaluate the risks, how to think about the benefits, and then how to choose. So trying to give people in some ways a little bit of a more pedantic way to kind of step through many of these decisions, in part because I think particularly as the virus has kind of gone on and on and on, there are just so many of these choices that they can be very overwhelming. And we are constantly in this like almost decision fatigue, and just having a way to kind of think about each choice separately, to evaluate it in a structured way, and then to move on. I think that hopefully is valuable for people in thinking some of these things through.
Yeah, I saw a commentator last week saying that basically this disease has kind of forced all of us to become our own individual personalized epidemiologists, evaluating our local data and trying to, you know, think through what we can do. So let's start with step one of your decision process. Frame the question. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I think part of the frame of the question is just literally think about what are the different choices that you are evaluating. So I think with something like people ask me, should I see grandparents? You know, should I see my elderly parents? Should I let my kids see them? And often that's all they say, like, should I see my grandparents, you know, the grandparents? And I've encouraged people to try to be a little more specific. Do you mean, should I see them now, like this weekend, or should I see them in 3 weeks? Do you mean, should I see them now, or should I wait until there's a vaccine in, you know, March of 2021? Should I see them now, or should I, you know, never see them again? So in some ways, like, people thinking about that choice requires you to think about what the two alternatives are, or the three alternatives, rather than just thinking, what should I do? Because what should I do is too vague to evaluate the costs and benefits. You really need to frame, what are you thinking about? And sometimes when people do that, they realize, oh, there really isn't an alternative. So people say, should I send my kid back to daycare? And you say, okay, well, think about the alternatives. They say, well, actually, there really isn't an alternative. I actually have no alternative option. And so then you think, well, I guess the answer must be yes, because you don't really have an alternative. And sometimes you'll realize the alternative is really much, much worse, or is just as risky. I think that that's helpful. So really just trying to be specific about what are you seeing as the relatively small number of choices that you could actually make, because then that will let you move forward on comparing them.
We need to take a short break. We're going to continue this conversation with Emily Oster after this break. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with economist Emily Oster, who teaches at Brown University and has authored several books and recently put together a new online resource called COVIDExplained.org. And listeners, again, we invite you to share your thoughts with us on Twitter at 21st Show. We want to know what decisions have been the most challenging for you to make, and how did you come to a decision? Again, tweet us at 21stshow. I want to read a text response we got from this Text the 21st group we have. This is from Naomi in Naperville. She writes on what has been the most challenging decision: when to allow our kids to participate in activities. Soccer practice just started back up, and pools, and if they should play with neighbors. We have allowed them back to two soccer practices so far with social distancing and small teams, and they can play with next door neighbors outside only, two kids. Keeping them busy has been challenging. I want to remind our listeners, you can answer questions like these and help shape our coverage on the show by joining our texting group. We're calling it Text the 21st. You just text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. So, Emily, my question for you is, both as an economist and a parent, how do you suggest parents make informed decisions on things like school, summer camp, playing with the neighbors, based on the information that's available?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, the first question that people want to ask is probably, you know, what can I do to do this as safely as possible, right? So if I'm going to think about going to soccer practice, let me think about what's the safest way to do that. And it sounds like the texter here is really thinking that through, thinking about how can we, you know, finding a place where it's socially distant. We know that being outside is safer, you know, thinking about, for example, what kind of symptom tracking or symptom monitoring is the camp gonna have? Are you gonna, you know, are they gonna send sick kids home? Those are the kinds of questions I would ask to sort of make sure that you're mitigating the risks as much as possible. And then I think people need to really sit down and think carefully about how big the risks are. And that's gonna depend a lot on where you are. So if you're in a very low prevalence place, you know, I live in Rhode Island, the prevalence in Rhode Island is very, very low at the moment. That's going to make it much less risky than if I lived in Texas. And I think you kind of want to confront directly, what are the share of people that I'm likely to encounter who are positive for the coronavirus. And, you know, that's something you can try to get a sense of from your local area. And then I think the other piece of this is just how large are the benefits, you know, and that's going to depend a lot on your kid and, you know, to some extent on you. The mental health costs for kids and being isolated has actually been pretty large. And I think some kids suffer from that more than others. And then, you know, at the end of the day, parents are going to have to, you know, to trade off kind of what they see as the risks, you know, the public health risks or the personal illness risks against really, you know, the benefits of getting outside and seeing other kids and, you know, having something to do other than watch Zoom videos all day.
Yeah. You know, and you had, so that's kind of talking about the next steps, which are mitigate risk, evaluate risk. And then you talk about evaluating the benefits and, you know, I love this line in your original post on this, which is, what are the benefits of having your child out of the house or taken care of by someone else? Are they infinite? I think maybe. And I mean, you're talking about, you know, going back to daycare or a summer camp or perhaps even in school in the fall. I've seen some articles recently about, you know, some parents opting to homeschool their children in the future, which I think is going to be a small subset of people who have the time and financial wherewithal and patience to be able to do that. But can you talk about how your view or how maybe our views of the benefits of getting kids back into some sort of social setting might have evolved over this, you know, time of isolation and now beginning of reintegration into society?
Yeah. So, my sense is that, and you know, people are probably different on this, but my sense is that the cost to kids of the kind of isolation and the lack of schooling have actually been quite a bit larger than people thought that they would be at the beginning. I think there's a few pieces of that. So one is, you know, we've seen really significant learning losses, at least to the extent we can measure them among, you know, particularly lower income kids and students of color, although not exclusively. So I think, you know, online Zoom school is just, you know, run by a bunch of parents who are trying to also have a job. That's just not, turns out not to be as effective as actual school.
Who knew?
And I think it was even worse than you might have anticipated. But I think the other piece of this is that this kind of isolation for some kids has been really hard. And, you know, I think we're in some ways, some of us are seeing that on the flip side now. So, you know, your kids are kind of going back out into the world, and it's hard to miss how much happier some of our kids are to go out and see their friends, you know, I think, or see just like anybody. And so I think that, you know, it's really hard. I mean, one of the other things I say in that piece is, you know, it's really hard to weigh benefits and costs in this space, because ultimately what you're saying is really, you know, are the benefits large enough to allow the possibility that my kid will get, will get the coronavirus. And, you know, fortunately kids are, tend to have very mild asymptomatic infection, but they could spread it to, you know, they could spread it to you and you could be sicker. So, you know, it isn't an easy thing to trade off, illness against joy. But in some sense that is the choice that we're going to have to be making. And, you know, unfortunately the kind of first best where there's no coronavirus is not available. And so we're going to have to kind of be in a second best world where we take some risk. We have to decide which risk we want to take.
Okay, so let's say we've framed the question, we've evaluated or we've mitigated the risks, thought about how we could mitigate the risk, evaluated the risk, evaluated the benefits, made our decision. Another thing you write about is that consistency of the decisions. And you had another post of sort of a follow-up to the original that said, it was called When to Change Your Mind. And you said, one of the hallmarks of good, effective decision-making is to be consistent. And you shared an example from one of your books about when you and your husband were sleep training your kids. Can you tell us about that and why consistency in decisions is so important?
Yeah, sure. So the example I talk about in the book is sort of thinking about, so we sleep training, which if for those of you who are not parenting small children refers to letting your kid cry until they, until they fall asleep to help them learn to fall asleep better on their own. So these people call it Ferberizing. He's like popularized this is a guy named Ferber. And so
it's kind of like putting yourself through military training. A little bit.
Yes. Military training for your 5-month-old. And so, you know, when we were doing this, we really sat down and thought very carefully about, you know, are there risks? Or, you know, what are the benefits? How should we do this? And we made the decision to do it. And, you know, for a bunch of reasons that are in the book. But then when you're actually doing it, it's very hard. So it's actually, it's very difficult to listen to your kid cry. And so frequently I would say, you know, well, let's just stop doing this because I can't take it. And, you know, my husband was very good at saying, look, we made this choice. We knew that this would happen. Like it's called cry it out. It's not called, you know, your kid goes to sleep and never cries. That's not that system, you know? And so we should have, we expected this. And so, you know, if you want to change what we're doing, you need to articulate, we need to articulate why we changed. And the answer was just, well, I'm not happy with this, but that actually isn't, maybe that's an okay reason to change your mind sometimes. But in this case, there wasn't any new information. It was just that I was finding it more difficult than I thought. And I think that applies to some of this here too, is that sort of, you know, once you make a decision, I think one of the things that has happened is then there will be an example where someone has COVID. And the question is, should that make me totally reevaluate everything? And I think the point I was trying to make there is that, you know, you should expect some people to have COVID. We're in the middle of a viral pandemic. And so we shouldn't necessarily respond by changing everything we're doing just because there is one case. We should think about, you know, is this more than I expected? Are things going worse than I had anticipated when I first made the choice?
Yeah, there was just a banner headline on the newspaper website in Springfield the other day. I think it was actually yesterday, about an employee of a daycare center tested positive for COVID-19. So, I mean, I think this is what you're getting at, is that maybe one data point is not something that should make us reevaluate the entire, you know, schema we've come up with.
Yeah, I mean, if your view is I would only be willing to send my kid to daycare if no one in any childcare centers ever gets COVID, then you should not initially send your kid to daycare, because there are going to be some people who work in childcare settings who get COVID. We don't think it's actually a particularly high risk group, so it's not as high risk as like bus driver or, you know, public transit worker or food service worker, but there are going to be some cases in any job. And I think that, you know, people may say, I'm not comfortable with that at all, but in that case, you shouldn't send the kid back in the first place.
And Emily, I wanted to ask, we got another comment on our Text the 21st group, and we asked him to record his response as a voice memo. Here's what he had to say.
Hi, this is John from Elgin. I find that dealing with social pressure and differing expectations can be kind of challenging. I've been yelled at by a stranger while I'm out on a run for not wearing a mask. And I've been made fun of for wearing a mask when I'm with my family. So the rules just seem to change based on how people are feeling at a given moment. And all I'm trying to do is make people happy.
Emily, I wonder if you have any advice on how, you know, sort of social pressure affects our decision making and how to deal with the expectations of others in these circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of the first thing I would say is like that, like, I think a lot of us are having this same experience. And in terms of, you know, what is the right, like, if you think the first thing you want to think about is like, what is the right sort of safe way to behave? And you think about something like masks, it's pretty clear that, you know, when you're in a store, you or some indoor activity where you're interacting with other people, you should be wearing a mask. I think it's also pretty clear that wearing a mask while you're running, you know, alone, in a distanced way from people is not necessary. And so, you know, there's kind of like, what is the right thing to do? And then there is like, how do I deal with the fact that everyone has a different view and is yelling at me? And in some ways, I think that people who have been parenting and who have been at the playground with other judgy parents are probably the best equipped to deal with this. And I think, you know, sometimes one of the things I say in one of my books is, you know, when people tell you, I can't believe you're doing it that way with your kid, you know, that's a terrible way to parent. You should just say, thanks so much for your thoughts on that. And then just move on. And so I feel like it's a little bit of the same, like I've been trying to just like, when people yell at me about the masks, like trying to just like, let it go. You know, I was out running with my daughter at some point, and somebody basically like, you know, I didn't have her in a mask, she's a little kid. And somebody basically like blocked the way, you know, to try to like, I don't know, yell at us about the mask. And I just like had her cross the street and said,
oh my goodness,
let's just try to move on.
Yeah, I had this moment the other day, too, where a guest we had on the show talked about, I like to ask reporters that we have on, are you seeing people wear masks in your area? Because in different parts of Illinois, you know, in the Chicago area, most people are wearing masks. Downstate, less so. This person said, well, yeah, at the gas station, I'm not seeing people wearing their masks. And I thought, well, geez, I don't wear a mask at the gas station. If I park at the far pump on the very end, but there's that idea that, am I doing harm by contributing to the idea that people should not be wearing masks? I don't know. Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, one of the things we try to do in the Explain COVID website is try to help people understand a little bit more about exactly how the virus works, which I think is helpful in explaining why masks, things like masks or hand washing, are effective. And I think part of what's happened is people have sort of gotten this impression that, like, you know, it, like the you could get the virus anywhere. It's like it could just jump onto you from 12 feet away. And I think people really understood, you know, you have to kind of like get virus particles on your hand and get them in your nose. nose. And the reason masks work is because they prevent the virus coming out, but also they prevent you from touching your face. And, you know, if you go to the grocery store and you don't touch your face and then you wash your hands, it's very unlikely you'd be infected. And so I think that kind of understanding of the details may help some people at least process understanding, you know, why being out for a run or being in a distant gas pump is different from being in, you know, Whole Foods with all the other people right close to you.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Emily Oster is an economist and a professor at Brown University. She's also the author of several books and one of the creators of the website COVIDExplained.org, which you can visit for help, as we just heard, on how to think about some of these COVID safety issues and better understand how the virus spreads and other things related to our new pandemic era. Emily, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.